We are starting a new series called Who's Asking the Question? And this is a something which sounds so obvious, but most people don't spend so much time on, and that is how to understand what the different Mefarshim are doing. Different Mefarshim are trying to achieve different things when they write their Pirush on the Torah, their explanation, and how do you understand the commentator? What are they trying to achieve? Where do you look if you're trying to ask a particular question or another question? How do you learn it? What do they mean? Where are they going? And it happens to be actually just recently I was at Koren Publishers. I happened to be at the RCA convention, the Rabbinic Council of America's convention. They had a stand there, and I bought Dr. Avigal Rach's book on called The Great Jewish Commentators, and she has an excellent rendition on sort of the background of commentators, as it happens to be. And in general, this is really worthwhile to explore this general topic as well, because I think most people are unaware of the full extent of it. And when we start thinking about Torah commentators, the first thing we start thinking about is Rashi, and then everybody afterwards as well. But the truth is that Rashi was not the first. In fact, in order to understand this, we're going to start today with our hats towards the translators, what we call the Targums, and there are many thereof. We're going to skip today the Tafsir HaRasag. Who's the Rasag? Rav Sadia Gaon, who translated the Torah into Arabic. We're not going to go in that direction today. We're going to look at the Aramaic translations for a second, trying to appreciate what they were doing, where they were from, and how this worked. So the question is how early does this begin? When does this really start for real? And the truth is, it starts much earlier than most people think it does. This is actually a pasuk in the Torah, it's in Tanakh itself. Again, everything comes back to Tanakh. And this pasuk takes us to the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. If you remember, Ezra and Nehemiah, thank you so much. Ezra is the spiritual leader of the Jewish people at the rebuilding of the second base of Mikdash. He's in the second wave of Aliyah. The first wave sort of got entrenched and got waylaid in the building of the base of Mikdash. Ezra and Nehemiah come along. Ezra is a spiritual leader. Nehemiah is the governor. He is a Persian Jew who is sent by the Persian emperor to the land of Judea to be the governor. And together they worked hand in hand to continue the needs of the people. And what happens is that it's not a very great spiritual landscape. There's assimilation, there's intermarriage. It's really not great. The Jews are a minority in the land of Israel at this time. Most of the Jews remain in Babylon, Persia area up north. And so, this is the landscape they arrive in is more complex. So what happens? They come to the land of Israel after achieving security, which is they rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Then at a certain point, they decide that on Rosh Hashanah, they're going to do a re-education process. They pull out a Sefer Torah and they read it on Rosh Hashanah. And it is the most effective Rosh Hashanah drasha of all ages, because everybody starts crying, right? So everybody is like broken down because they hear about they're reading Devarim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you're going to go into the land and you're not going to listen and you're going to disobey me and you're going to start intermarrying, and everybody's looking at themselves in the mirror and it's very embarrassing and everybody feels very, very, very upset. They start crying, and Ezra and Nehemiah turn them home and then after this and say to them, don't worry, go home. Today's a day of festivity. Come back afterwards. And then, because Rosh Hashanah is supposed to be a happy day, they come back. There's this spiritual reformation that occurs after this. This is like it's a watershed event in the Nehemiah Perek Ches. Now, when reading the Torah, this is what we're told. It describes that they didn't just read the Torah to the people. It describes, as our first source, Vayikra'u b'sefer Toras Elohim. They read the book of the teachings of God, Meforash, explicit, v'sum seichel v'yavino b'mikra. They did it in a way that makes sense, and so everybody could understand the reading. What does that mean, pray tell? How could they understand this? So the Gemara Megillah explains that means to say that we're going to start from the middle of the first line. It says, "Amar Rav Ikar bar Avin, Amar Rav Chanan el Amar Rav, Ma'idich Siva Yikru b'Sefer Torah Zelikim Meforash v'sum seichel v'yavino b'mikra." What does it mean that they read it explicitly? V'yikru b'Sefer Torah Zelikim Zemikra. That means they read the psukim. Meforash. When it means explicit, it means zuat targum. They translated it into Aramaic. V'sum seichel ela psukim. They divided it into sentences. V'yavino b'mikra. They made it understood. Ela psukim, which means what we call today, trap, which means cantillation. the notes. V'amrilei ela mesores, and these are the mesores, which means mesores. These are the ways that, if you look at the old, what's called mesora, it's the amount, it's sort of the amount of letters and the amount of words and all the and the specific uniquenesses of letters and full words. Shirachum v'chazru yistun, they were forgotten and reestablished at this time. So Ezra reestablished, and this relates to the fact that Ezra did a lot to the, we'll call, Torah teaching process in general. In fact, the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that if the Torah had not been given by Moshe, it would have been given by Ezra, because Ezra reestablished it, that he changed the text, the syntax as well, of the Torah, shifting it from what was the Ksav Ivri, the old Ugaritic script, to the what we call Ksav Ashuri, which is the script we have today. A lot happened, and that surrounds this particular event. A lot to understand. But nonetheless, you see that he did explain it in Targum, in Aramaic. Now, how long ago was this episode? When did this actually occur? How long ago was did this episode actually happen in Jewish history? Just to give us numbers of years.
About 2,500.
Yeah, we're about 2,500 years ago, right? So we have like 2,500 years ago is when we were in translation. So, you know, when we think about Rashi and we think about explanations of the Torah, Rashi was 900 years ago. Sorry, yeah, Rashi was 900 years ago, right? So that's recent in Jewish history. Right, 2,500 years ago is much, much further back. We're digging much deeper. So you say to yourself, well, why did he need to do this? So the reason is let's just listen to what actually was going on at that time. Here's what the Rambam says as to why Anshei Knesset Gedolah, who Nehemiah and Ezra were part of, right, why they established the Shemona Esra at that time as we have it today. Why? He explains in source 3, he says, Kevin Shigali Yisrael bimei Nebuchadnezzar Rasha. Once the nation of Israel were exiled in times of Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian, Nisarvu Pefras v'Yavon u'Shar Amos, they became interdispersed among the Persians and the Greeks later on and the other nations. The Noldu Lohem Bonim v'Artos Agoyim v'Oysom Abonim Nisbal Belus v'Osom v'Oysosafas Kol Echad v'Echad Mo'oreves Miloshonos Harbeg. They had accents of all the other nations. They weren't involved. They didn't understand what they were really saying. They had no central language. No language anchored them together. The pasuk in Nehemiah as well. Their children were speaking Ashdodis. Where's Ashdod? That's part of what's the coastal Gaza area. Right, so ve'enam makirim ledaber Yehudis kiloshon am va'am. They couldn't even speak Yehudis. Yehudis means Hebrew, right? So they weren't able to. They didn't have the natural anchor, and that's why he goes on to say, umibnei ze kishayah echad mehem ispalel tiktzar leshonah lishol chavatzov lo'agid shevach haKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, when one would ask, the one would start praying, they would be inappropriate. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't flow. They wouldn't be able to say it properly, and therefore that's why Ezra and Nehemiah sort of established this framework of prayer called the Shemona Esrei in Hebrew, and this is how you say it, because we're not going to rely on the organic expression of human beings when it's so broken and so fractured as a function of exile and assimilation. So that is the environment in which this is said, and therefore says the Rambam 12 prakim later on in the Hilchos Tefillah, Mimois Ezra Nagu Shiei Shom Turgamon Metargeim Lo'am Masha Korei Korei Batorah. So they would translate the reading of the Torah into Aramaic, Kadesh Yavinu Inyan Hadvarim, so people should understand it. So you say, well, why Aramaic? It's so fascinating. Aramaic, interestingly enough, was the language spoken in which country? Well, it's actually the language spoken in Aram, right? Aram, in fact, was the kingdom north of Israel during the first base of Midrash, towards the end. They were the northern kingdom. And in fact, when you spend time reading a little bit about Ahav and his escapades with Aram, Naaman, who was the general of Aram at the times of Elisha, you read all these, Aram was the central country above Israel, and they had many, we'll call complexities when Judah and Israel, when the two provinces of the country of Israel, which was split into two kingdoms, had wars with each other. There's many times where Aram is conscripted into one of the sides. So it's one of the countries that's surrounding Israel. It's Aram. Aram was ultimately conquered by which country? It was conquered not by a country. In fact, it was conquered by an empire called Assyria. What is fascinating is, about Aram, is although they were conquered by Assyria, their language was adopted by Assyria. Such interesting. So in Ashur, they spoke Armenian, right? They spoke Aramaic. Perhaps it would be better, more treated. So they spoke Aramaic. And in fact, therefore, when the Assyrians were overcome by the Babylonians, they continued that adoption. And it became that in the Middle East, Aramaic was the lingua franca. It was the language, it was the international language in the Aramaic that ultimately every conqueror, so to speak, adopted this language. It's fascinating because Aram was long gone by that time. But Aramaic carried on going. And it stayed, right? It stayed for a long time, ultimately, and that's why the Gemara itself is in Aramaic. Now, the Gemara, the Mishnah is in Hebrew. The Mishnah was based in Israel, but the Gemara, the Babylonian Talmud, was written in Babylon, and that was the language. And so, to the Yerushalmi Talmud, was also written in Aramaic. That's why it's sometimes more difficult to learn. And that was the language that Ezra was speaking for centuries. So what Ezra was doing, what essentially was saying, it was kind of like Lahavdil, the English of the time, right? So I remember I once was going through Europe in a return flight to Israel, and so I stopped off in Prague, and so we wanted to spend like 16 hours to go check out Prague. It was great, and so I'm in this taxi, and there's this fellow in the back who's Romanian, right? And the taxi driver is Czech, right? So they're trying to communicate, but they have no idea what they're talking. So they're trying to speak to each other in broken English. And I was like sitting there, like listening to this. It's like, it's really funny. That was always happening, right? So you have the some Jews are speaking Greek, some Jews are speaking a Babylonian and Median, and how they communicate with each other is through Aramaic, right? Aramaic becomes the touch point of communication. So when trying to explain the Torah, as opposed to trying to get divided into many multiple fractured languages, Aramaic becomes the language through which the Torah is understood. Okay, so that's why this is being translated this time. That's why Ezra uses this, speaking to a population who is deficient in their understanding of basic Judaism and basic Hebrew. That's why it's translated at such a time. So really, it's very important to appreciate this. And this also helps us understand a lot of the halachas that surround this as well. So for instance, we know that if anybody who learns the Mishnah and the Megillah knows that there's a lot of halachas which surround Targum, right? The Targum as well. So for instance, there are certain parts of the Torah which are, you know, rated a little more, you know, sensitive, and they're not translated. So the Mishnah tells us, Ma'aseh Reuven Nikra V'lo Mitargem. The whole episode of Reuven, right? What's Reuven doing? And the father of Yaakov, that pasuk's not translated. Ma'aseh Tamar Nikrova Nikra Mitargem. But when it comes to Tamar and Yehuda, that is translated. Ma'aseh Egel Arishon Nikra Umitargem Hasheni Nikra V'lo Mitargem. So the Mishnah goes through all these ideas because when you're dealing with the unwashed masses who don't always appreciate all the nuances of things, not everything, it's there's sensitive nature things, and it's not meant to be understood by people. Now remember, this is the Mishnah. The Mishnah is being redacted 700 years later, right? So the Mishnah is around the year 200 Common Era. That's 700 years after Ezra's already introduced this. And at that point in time, it seems to be that's common practice, right? They would read the Torah, and there's the halachas. How many psukim would you read in Hebrew before translating into Aramaic? And how loud the translator could be or couldn't be, right? That'd be a lower than the tone of the Torah. Now, if everybody complains about the length of our Torah readings, yeah, we should try with the translation as well. But that's the way it worked, right? So that would be how it worked, because the average person was not schooled and was not lettered, and they needed the translation to understand what was going on. Right?
Why did they remove parts of it from the translation? I didn't understand.
Oh, because certain parts were more sensitive in nature, and perhaps had more of a, there was also more of a, could be misunderstood or
well, weren't they reading it for us? I mean, it's too sensitive for us to hear it.
You're right. So if you go through the Mefarshim on this Mishnah, the Gemara itself goes on to this. There's certain more embarrassing parts about certain leaders, and so it's we sort of de-emphasize the focus on that. So you know the scholars would be, yeah, we get that, and the plebeians would be like, whoop, okay, I guess the Kiddush is coming faster, right? That would be like how that would be the way it would work. So that's what the Mishnah is saying, but just fascinating, right? And same thing with Haftorahs as well, the Mishnah goes on to say. So, and the Gemara goes on to expand all these situations. There's a lot of cases which had more sensitivity as to translation. But for the fact that the Mishnah is saying this, clearly that was in practice at the times of the Mishnah. Right? Meaning, the Mishnah is not saying, oh, there was this practice yesteryear. The Mishnah is saying, no, this is what we're doing. Right? So, really, really fascinating as well. Now, just on that note, so you said to yourself, well, like, I don't see that so much anymore. So the reason is actually when the Rambam quotes this pretty much verbatim. Now remember, the Rambam is writing 800 years ago, right? So the Rambam doesn't give any provisos, conditions, concerns about this thing. It's as if it's normal, right? And none of the Mefarshim will talk about that. But if you go to the tour in Siman Kuf Mem Hei, which is where all that is, I didn't put this in the notes, but the tour actually points us out in the halachas of Kriyas HaTorah. And his observation of is as follows. The Torah, of course, is Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher, writing in the 1400s, who says the following. He says that he says it is clear from the times of the Gemara, and he quotes the Tosfos who quotes Rabbi Chalafta, that it wasn't necessary to have a Meturgamon, meaning it seems from a Braisa that there were certain places that had Meturgamon. There were certain places that did not have a Meturgamon. There were certain places that had translated, and some people were places that didn't. So he says, so his observation is, Mikan Sa'ad, this is a proof, Leminag Shelanu, to our practice, She'ein Anu Regilim Targem. We don't translate, generally speaking, today. Barmin Nami Yerushalmi, Min Ma Da'ano Anachami, Rabon Anafki Latanis, the Vakari Veloi Mitargami, Chada Amra She'ein Matirgum Akev. So you see that they were used to on a fast day, they wouldn't translate the Torah reading, so you see it isn't absolutely necessary for that. Today we no longer speak Aramaic, so it's not helpful anymore, it's more of a hindrance to understand it. So you say, well, let's speak it in English. So he says it's not going to be helpful because English was not given in Lashon HaKodesh. And in fact, if you look at the Gemara in Nedarim Lamed Zayin Beis, the Gemara tells us that pasuk in Ezra and Nehemiah was in fact said al pi ruach HaKodesh. And in fact, that takes us back to our first source, our second source which we read. The Gemara actually says, who is the one who translated the Torah into Aramaic? Well, who is the translator? The Gemara says, Targum Shoy Torah Unkulos Hager Amora, just said by Unkulos Hager. The Gemara questions that by saying, wasn't it taught in the times of Ezra, which is much earlier? So the Gemara says, Shechachum V'chazrum V'yistum. It was forgotten and it was reestablished by Unkulos, which means to say that there was a deep tradition that goes back. In fact, so much so that the Gemara in Darim tells us it goes all the way back to Halach L'Mashir Sinai. There were certain ideas that were transmitted, the understanding of the Torah which was transmitted at Sinai, and ultimately were captured in the Tirgum. And so that had an element of Ruach HaKodesh to it. It had an element of divine inspiration. So for somebody just to get up there and translate the Torah into what they think it means is a gross devaluing of the Torah. So therefore we don't go there to new languages. When it was Aramaic and it was instituted at a time where there was prophecy still around and they knew what they were doing, then that had value. Now we don't understand it, so it's our loss. But we're not going to retranslate it as well. We do find, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so the way that the Gemara is framing it is that Unkelos was reestablishing a forgotten tradition which did have Ruach HaKodesh. So he himself didn't, but he was able to resurrect it. Now there's a lot of questions surrounding that. We'll get there in a second. But I do want to note that there is a, we'll call it domesticated vestigial reminder of this, and that's what we call Shnai Mikra V'Echa Targum. So the Shnai Mikra V'Echa Targum is clearly a reflection of what was meant to be done in Shul, right? So in Shul, the Torah is being read and it's being translated, right? So then there became a practice on an annual cycle for people before they got to Shul to read and translate the Torah, Shnai Mikra V'Echa Targum, and that would be, so to speak, the domesticated version of what would be going on in Shul. And in fact, that still is La Halacha. It's in Siman Reish Pei Hey in the Halachas of Shabbos that a person is supposed to do this. And over there, the discussion is Targum. is translation. So, and that translation is Aramaic. And if you go through it, it's actually discussed in Halacha. The Ber Halacha says, but what about today? Same question, where we don't understand Targum. Now, to be honest, it is a little bit of a push me, pull you, right? So meaning, I'm pretty fluent in Aramaic, but that's because I spent a lot of time learning the Targum and learning the Gemara, right? But that's because I spent the time. Now, when I go back to it, now I understand what he's saying and I can understand what he's teaching me, but that's because I spent all the time breaking my teeth on it for years. So it's a little bit of a push me, pull you, right? But there's a discussion in the Ber Halacha, and the Ber Halacha quotes Rav Nitrai God, who says, well, listen, we don't understand Aramaic anymore. He says, well, on the other hand, he says, so maybe we should just redo the Targum in a language we understand. And he says, but the problem is that it goes back to the idea that was just mentioned over here in the Torah, is that this Targum has a deeper and more illustrious history, which is rooted perhaps in Ruach HaKodesh, so it is more valuable to be learning the Targum more than anything else. However, there are Achronim, the Ber Halacha acknowledges them, and so there are many today who suggest that, let's say you want to use the Stone Edition in Chumash, which is a translation which is rooted in tradition, that could certainly suffice for Shlomi Kravecha Targum. Any translation, not necessarily, because there's a lot of academics who wrote translations, and that's very nice, and they're wonderful and brilliant minds, but they certainly were not rooted in tradition. And so therefore their translations are interpretations, and many times translations are misinterpretations or limited interpretations. So one has to be careful about that. The Stone Edition happens to be is that, generally speaking, if you read their introduction, it's based on Rashi. Right? Rashi is based on Midrash, and so therefore that would be, so to speak, fall more into the milieu of the Targum. We'll see why in just a second. Now, who translated it? It sounds like the translation of the Torah was done by Unculus, which is, obviously, it's funny, because if Ezra's doing a Targum, Unculus wasn't around that time, right? So Unculus is like much, much later. So clearly, it wasn't called Targum Unculus at the time. It was some Aramaic translation. It sounds like Unculus is where he's found the manuscripts, or he had some divine inspiration to rediscover it. Here's something that is going on. But the Gemara tells us in Megillah, Gimel Amud Aleph, in Source 5, Amar Rabbi Yirmiyahu v'Itamar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Targum shel Torah Unculus ager amara mipi Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yeshua. So he had a tradition from Rabbi Eliezer and Yeshua. And Targum Shel Neviim, Yonasan ben Uzziel Amara mipi Chagai Zecharia Malach, and his tradition came from the last of the prophets. When he's Dazeh Eretz Yisrael, Arba Meos Parsa, Arba Meos Parsa. And when he translated the Neviim, the land, so there was an earthquake, a spiritual earthquake, it sounds like, because of his translation. Yotza Baskol Va'amra, and a divine voice that was emitted, which said, Me who ze shigila sisorai livnei Adam, who revealed my secrets to humanity. Amad Yonatan ben Uzziel, Araglo Va'amar, Yonatan ben Uzziel stands up and says, Ani hu shigili sisorecha livnei Adam, I'm the one who did this. I did it not for my own honor, but for the honor of your honor, and I did it so that people would not have arguments. And he wanted to translate and reveal the tradition as to what the scriptures mean. That's enough. You understand, Nazil? So back down from that. There's no more need. So the Gemara says, why? My time and Mishum to Isbe Kates Mashiach. Because the end of because you start reading in Daniel and the scriptures, and there's stuff there that really relates to the end. It's very vague business over there. It's interesting. I was actually just reading Antiquities yesterday. Josephus writes the Antiquities of the Jews. He talks about how, as Alexander the Macedonian arrives in the land of Israel, and the Jews are anxious to curry favor in the face of the new power in the East, now no longer Persia but now Greece. So one of the things they do is they whip out the Sefer Daniel and they show it to Alexander, and they say, you see, the Greeks are destroyed by the Persians in our prophecies. And that made him very happy, because he said, that must have been me, right? Anyway, that was one of the things. So, but Daniel, the book of Daniel, has a lot of stuff there, right? There's a lot of things. So don't translate that, because it's very vague and, you know, easy to be misinterpreted. It was actually itself, by the way, in Aramaic itself. So clearly, Yonatan ben Uzziel is doing more than just the language, right? Which is what we'll see in a second as well. Now, by the way, who came earlier, Unculus or Yonatan ben Uzziel? Yonatan ben Uzziel, because Yonatan ben Uzziel was a Talmud of Hillel. Hillel was at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Uncle Zager is a Talmud of Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar Gadol is after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash as well. So just a two-generation gap. So Uncle actually comes later in terms of just in terms of the timing. Notice over here, by the way, that the Gemara does not say. The Gemara does not tell us that Yonatan ben Uzziel wrote a Pirush on the Torah. Right? He was a translator of the Nevi'im, and the one who translated the Torah was Unkelus Sager. Who was Unkelus? This is a very famous story that appears in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Aleph. The Gemara tells us about Unkelus Bar Klonimus, and he was some Roman dignitary. He converted to Judaism, and we hear this whole story. It's a very famous story about how they how Titus sent a group of soldiers to go convert him to bring him back, and then he was able to prevail upon them about the beauty of Judaism, and then he and then they converted, and he sent another legion, and he prevailed upon them, and very very beautiful arguments you can see in the Gemara Avodah Zarah that he brings to all of them. Very fascinating, obviously a very charismatic, very very knowledgeable individual as well. It is interesting to note that there are, academically speaking, hesitations as to who actually did the translation. When Unkelus actually lived. So for instance, there's an essay by Dr. Israel Drazen, who writes in this. It's published on the Sfarim blog, who points out that there are. It's a long essay, but he points out that there are 698 similarities between Unkelus' translation and many of the Midrashi Halacha. So meaning to say that Unkelus is understanding and interpreting the Torah based on Midrash Halacha, and the Midrash Halacha actually is later than the assumed date of this, and so he makes an assumption that this Unkelus person must have lived perhaps a little later than the first or second century CE, but rather around the year 400, which would incorporate all the Midrash Halacha. Again, you know, there's a lot of academic supposition on this topic as well. It's interesting that Rav Tzios Chayas, right, the Maritz Chayas, assumed that it was actually the work of Akila of Sinope, just attributing it to an individual who lived as well early on as well. In the terms of the Targum Yonasan, Targum Yonasan is a little more complex because we have Targum Yonasan on Nevi'im, as the Gemara tells us, and then we have Targum Unkelus on the Torah. But there happens to be, if you open up Chumar Midrash Gedolos, you'll see Targum Yonasan on the Torah as well. So academically speaking, it's called Pseudo-Jonathan, right? So why is that? It's a very derogatory way of describing a Pirush. Why is that? So it turns out that it is referenced. There is a notion about there being another translation of the Torah. So even Rav Haigon notes this in his responsa, and he says in source 9, he says, "Shishaltim targum eretz Yisrael mishum man itmar." He says, "I know there's a translation from Israel. Who said it? Upirusha de isbe katnus legaris my havi alasa. Ein onu yoidim targum eretz Yisrael mi amorai vaf ein onu yoidim oisoi gufoi veloi shamanu mimenu elamaat." So Rav Haigon is speaking in Babylonia. Says, I haven't really had so much access to it. I've seen snippets of it, but I don't really know who it is. But there clearly is this, what he calls a Targum Eretz Yisrael. And it's interesting that Targum Unkelus becomes known as the Babylonian translation, and the Targum Eretz Yisrael becomes this Jerusalem Targum, which is referred to as well. In fact, it's so respected and revered that the Kolboy describes in Source 10, quoting Rav Maharam Mirutenberg, the great leader of the Germanic states, about 700-800 years ago, says, "Oikos of Harav Rebbe Meir, she'ena mo'il kach kashe'odam choyze gimel pami mikra, komo shi'achzor beiz pami mikra ve'echa targum." This whole halachic discussion is, if you don't have a targum on a pasuk, do you say the pasuk three times instead of one targum, or do you say targum if it's the same words? And he points out, "Ki min adin ha'yol ala nachzor targum Yerushalmi, lefi she'betov yoser mefaresh ha'ivri yoser min ha'targum shelanu." He says, we don't have access to the Jerusalem translation, right? The one that comes from Israel. It is actually more explicit and a better translation than our translation referring to Targum Unkelus, but we don't have it. It's not extant, right? And so it doesn't seem to be that they have access of it to it in Europe. There's this Jerusalem translation, and that's what seems to be what we have is Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel. Later on, it became known as Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel. Some would say it's a scribal error. This is where it comes from, is because the way it's usually quoted is Taf Yud with an apostrophe, and that is probably referring to Targum Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem translation, and some became to interpret it as Targum Yonatan as a function of that, which is why the scholars will say it's pseudo-Jonathan. It's really not Yonatan ben Uzziel. It was confused with the Targum Yerushalmi. At the same time, I just want to acknowledge, and I think it's important to notice this, is actually Dr. Yeager very kindly got me this. I've been going through Targum Yonatan ben Uzziel this year as on the Torah, which is fascinating. It's riveting. It's really an amazing. It's a completely different way of looking at the Torah. So Dr. Yeager got me a translation of Targum Yonatan HaMavuar, which is excellent. So in his introduction to this, of course, he addresses all the issues. And he says, and he makes an observation, he says, it may be true that the academics say it's pseudo-Jonathan, but he says, in the end of the day, he says that a lot of folks who still, and he quotes them, he says, these are people who still call the Targum Yonatan ben Uzziel on the Torah. The Tosafos, the Rikanti, the Maral, the Gra, the Baal Panim Eros, and many more. So he says, like, you got to be careful. If they call the Targum Yonatan ben Uzziel on the Torah, you want to just be more hesitant to suggest that it's pseudo-Jonathan, right?
But it wasn't right. Only the academics. Yeah. There were some Rishonim.
You're right. There were some Rishonim who made the observation that Targum Eretz Yisrael became Targum Yonatan as well. But nonetheless, he feels that, and the fact that if you open your average Chumash today, it still says Targum Yonatan, one should just be more careful about being about just sort of dismissing it as being it. But irrespective of who actually wrote it, it's very clear that this was a Targum that originated in Israel, and it's somewhat different to the Targum Unkelus as well, as it appears. There are other academic questions about it, because it does make reference to things which seem, or places and names which seem to be after certainly Yonatan ben Uzziel on the Torah. So for instance, as an example, it references Fatima, right? So there's anti-Islamic polemic, right, embedded in the Targum Yonatan as well, which clearly is after the 7th century, right? Because so that must be referring or referencing what happened then. And the way that this Targum Yonatan HaMavuar addresses this, he says, yeah, well, assuming that the Targum was something which was being done on a weekly basis, and the translators would get up there in shul and translate, what they would do is they would also make it more amenable. They make it more understandable to the populace as well. So they may have thrown in a few extras as well, but that doesn't take away from the core, which was fascinating. Just interesting observation over here. But Tachlis, without all the academia for a second, because I'm more interested actually than what's going on over here. Just a few. I'd like to go through a few examples of what they're up to and what they're trying to do, because I think this is really more important to us than all the history. First of all, is the danger of translation. We see that translation itself, sometimes we say, is a translation. Why is this even in the shir about Mefarshim? Like, what does this got to do with the Mefarshim? The answer is that translation is interpretation. Just we have to understand that. And that's why the Torah wasn't translated. The Torah, in a certain sense, that's why there's no nekudos. There's no cancellation, because all of those are already interpretation of the Torah itself. The Torah exists on a higher plane, and once you explain it or explicitly circumscribe it, then you're already limiting it as well. So the Gemara describes that a person who translates, if you add on anything or you take away something, it's already considered a megareah, and it's already considered a megadeh. You have to be very, very careful about this. Gemara describes as well. In terms of wordplay, once you start translating, you lose wordplay. For instance, when Hashem says that he describes that the woman is called woman, he says, Isha, why? Kimi ish lo kacha zois, right? So clearly the Torah in Hebrew is telling us the word ish and isha are related to each other, right? Whereas if you start translating into Aramaic, it's not so clear. So for instance, the way it's translated is itza mibala, right? Itza is a woman, mibala. That's ish. The words aren't connected to each other, right? So you've lost that wordplay already in the translation.
El hakuba, velishel
kavasa. Right, exactly. Same thing with arum. The nachash haya arum and the arumim, right? So anytime over there, one means is translated as deception, and the other one is translated as naked. Now the Torah clearly is putting those two psukim back to back to tell us there's a relationship between the two of them, right? That should be clear. But already in the translation, you're losing that as well. So Translation has that danger. On the one hand, it expands, it makes it more understandable. On the other hand, it's also interpreting in a way that we're losing some of the wordplay and some of the context as well. But let's look at some of the hallmark of what they're trying to do. One of the things, one of the most noticeable goals of Unculus is the Targum Unculus in the Torah, is that he avoids any anthropomorphisms, right? So we know that the Rambam is very clear that one of the 13 principles of faith is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu eino demus haguf ve'eino guf. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it has no body and does not express himself in a body or in human terms. And so the Targum Unculus, based on that principle of faith, now it wasn't that the Unculus was reading the Rambam, right? That's a principle of faith, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has no body. So anytime the Torah will use any anthropomorphism or any anthropopathism, which means any bodily expression or any emotional expression, the Unculus will diminish will that as well. So like, let's take a look at two examples. In source 18, the Torah tells us, V'aboyim zachar nakeva mikol basar bo'u b'kasher tzivah asav elakim, ma'yizkor Hashem ma'adai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu closed it. What are we referring to? Closed it, we're referring to what? The door of the ark, right? So Hashem is closing the door of the ark once all the humans and animals are in there. Now that is an anthropomorphism, right? That is a human action. Says the Targum Unculus, V'olaya dechar v'nokba. So enters the male and female, right? By the way, dechar, just in with the word, the letter dalet, of course, is always interchangeable with the word Zion. Dechar v'nokba, mikol bisra, from all the flesh. Alu kamoi dipakid yosei Hashem, they entered as Hashem commanded. V'agan Hashem Alohi. What does that mean? V'agan Hashem Alohi means that Hashem protected them. So when it says God is closing the door, what that really means is Hashem is, so to speak, protecting them. So it's moving away from an action, but more to an aura, to an expression. Another example in source 19. V'yorach Hashem es reach hanichoach. God smelled the pleasant aroma. Says the Targum Unculus, V'kabil Hashem berava yos kurbonei. Hashem received or accepted with pleasure. What do that mean? In His will, this korban. V'amar Hashem bemeimre lo oisif oid lemeilat oid yos ara bedil chay ve'anosha. So again, lowering, so to speak, the idea of Hashem actually doing or expressing something in a human fashion. And this is going to be consistent across the whole Torah. If you want to understand what a action related to God is, read the Targum Unculus and he will explain it in larger terms, right? So not limited to human action. That's one idea as well. Other parts of the Targum is that there's something poetic. He'll explain what the poetry is as well. So for instance, in source 20, this is the brachas of Yaakov Avinu to Yehuda. He's tying this donkey to the vine. Right, so what is this referring to? So the Targum Unculus is explaining this to us. He says, "Yas char Yisrael lekartei amo yivnun heichla yehun tzadikaya sechor secharle." So when they build their city, there'll be tzadikim around this. What city we're referring to? Jerusalem, which is where Yehuda is going to be the place of this. Va'avde arisa bu'ulfan ime, and they're going to be learning and teaching Torah with them. Yehi argavon tav levushi kasusei mila mila tzvaz zohari v'tziv oinin, and they're going to be wearing the royal garb as they're teaching Torah. So now, what it seemed to be like a image of a donkey being tied to a vine is now understood to be in the milieu of the expression of Yerushalayim being sanctified by its Torah teachers as well. There are times where misunderstanding has to be avoided. So again, they sound like such simple things, but this is the methodology of the Targum. Mimosh, do you have a question?
Are we to understand that this stylistic form of Unculus was his, or he copied what he knew from Ezra?
It sounds as going with what Gemara is saying, is this is specifically what he's doing. No. This is specifically what his tradition was. The tradition was is that in understanding the Torah, we need to understand that the Torah was not meaning that Hashem walked and had hands, right? Right. So if you really want to understand what the Torah means, that's what Unculus is saying, is this is what the tradition is. And if you really want to understand these parables, this is the tradition that we have of what this parable means. That's the way we sort of do. So as opposed to Unculus sort of sitting there on the rock and saying, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if this was referring to... what we're saying is that he is sort of, whether he got hold of the manuscripts or whether he himself was divinely inspired, he's saying this is what this must refer to as well. Now, doesn't mean to say that we can't say that there might be other interpretations, right?
Rashi, but this is all the time.
What was that? Yeah, Rashi.
Rashi,
Rashi argues onkelos many, many times, and Menachem ben Sarukah as well. There are many, many people who disagree. But nonetheless, this seems to be, we'll call it one strand of ancient tradition. Another example, a misunderstanding. So for instance, the word Mizbeach, this is so interesting, is that you can have certain words which are actually translated differently based on the context. So for instance, when it describes an altar, right? So Noach comes out of the Teva, he's sacrificing on it. Vayivin Noach Mizbeach. So the way it's translated over there is Noach Mad Becha. Kodem Hashem. He builds a Mad Becha. Again, the Zion and the Dalet are interchangeable. Mad Becha is Mizbeach, right? But when it comes to heathens who are using altar, later on in Parshas Mishpatim, it's not Mishpatim, this is in Kisisa, in source 22, Kiyas Mizbechoseyem Titzoy Tzun, you should destroy their altars. Listen to the word over there. He says, Are Yos Agorehon Tisarun, right? Tisraun. So you shall destroy their agrohoin. That is a different word, which means to say that don't think that they have altars and we have altars and we just are sacrificing to different deities. No. We have the altar, they have some sort of other thing as well. Just understanding the difference over here. Another example I found, which I always think is fascinating, is both Avram and Sarah laugh when they hear about have a child in their late 90s, right? Early and late 90s. So, yet Avram Avinu is not called to task, and Sarah is, right? So the end of Parashas Lech Lecha, Vayipol Avram al Panova Yitzchak b'liboy. He laughs. Haleben mea shana yivoled, v'im Sarah ababas tishim shana teled. Is this going to really happen? Now all the Mepharshim struggle to explain why he's not punished and where Sarah is. But look at the Targum Unkelus. It says, Unapal Avram al Apoy v'chadi. What's the word chadi mean?
Happy.
Chedva, right? He's happy. The meaning say his laugh is an expression of joy. Look at source 24. That's Sarah. Vatischak Sarah bekirba leimor acharei belasiya isila nava adoniz lakein. Says vachayches Sarah. Chayech is to laugh, to scorn. Right. So already, what the Targum Unkelus is explaining is it may look like the same word. Right. It may look like a mizbeach. It may look like the word vatischak, but really there's a different. We'll call it emotional underpinning over here, which will now distinguish it as well. Other ideas is like, let's say, complicated idioms. Like, so idioms change all the time, right? We use idioms all the time, but we have no idea what we're saying, right? So there were also Torah idioms, and there were later idioms which needed interpretation. So for instance, in Vayechazek Hashem Eslei Paroi, Vayemelech Mitzrayim, source 25, Vayudov Acharei B'nei Yisrael, B'nei Yisrael Yotzim B'yad Ramah, Israel going out with a raised hand. A raised hand is clearly a symbol of something. Victory, it sounds like, right? The way that he translates is Nefaku B'reish Gali. He says they went out with an uncovered head. Now, by the way, we don't use either of those idioms today, right? You don't talk about right victory or victory, right? But that is it, right. So it sounds like the Targum Unkelus is giving us a perhaps a more contemporary idiom as to what that looks like at the times when he's talking as well. But again, we have to keep going backwards to appreciate this as well. Similarly. I found this is always fascinating. When describing Yishmael, right? So the prophecy given to Hagar, don't worry, Hagar, it's going to be all right. He's going to be a great nation. Then he's told, "Who yeh pere adam?" He's going to be a wild man. Yodoy ba'kol v'yad kol boy. His hand is in everything and everything's hand is in his. What does that mean? I always found this one fascinating because, again, we don't have a parallel idiom. We don't have, like, a way of interpreting that. Says the Targum Unkelus, he's going to rebel against all of humanity. Doesn't go with the norms of the time. He will need everybody and everybody will need him. We call that oil. Okay? It used to be the silk trade and then it became oil. But understand what that means. Is that so? Like that is a very apt translation or interpretation of what that idiom means. As example of what the Arabs are as well. And there's times where the euphemism is employed in Unkelus. Again, when you look at the Targum, you're like, oh, it's just a translation. It's like, no, he's helping us understand some of the ideas. So for instance, when it talks about Yaakov Avinu just slips out having just taken the brachos, the goatskin and the arms, the whole business. Yitzchak Avinu now has encounters son number two, who's also called Esav, and then he says to him, Vayomer, bo achicha bir mimra, v'yikach his birchasecha. Your brother came, what's b'mirma? So we always say it's the deceit, right? And so Unkelus says, not really, he says, Bechachmasa. Chachmasa is cunning, Right, that's what we call a euphemism over here. Right, so he euphemizes what's going on over here, whether that means to say that the ends justify the means, or because of the nevuah of Rivka, whatever it is, the point is don't misinterpret it as this is backhanded and cheating as well in this particular case. This was well-founded, even though the methods employed were complicated. Similarly as well, it follows Targum Unculus, and this is what Dr. Drazen was referring to, and will incorporate Midrash Halacha many times. So Midrash Halacha is the way that, the Sifrei, the Sifra, the Mechilta will interpret a Pasuk. So for instance, Shofech Dam Ha'adam Ba'adam Damo Yishofech, which by the way is a chiasm, right? So a person spills blood in blood of a person in a person, their blood will be spilt. And the Unkelus translator is the Yishod Damo De'enosh, a person will spill the blood of a person. Besadin, with witnesses, al meimar dalenaya deme yishtabar yishtod. And then, it's not that, oh, you know, you can set up your own jury and go kill anybody who you think is doing this. No. With when there is going to be witnesses and a due process, then there's going to be the possibility of capital punishment as well. So again, pulling in Midrash Halacha into understanding the text as well, as part of the tradition as well. So there's a lot of things that Unkelus is doing, which are going to follow through the interpretation of the Torah. The problem is that you need to really be sufficiently proficient in Aramaic to understand when he's doing this, because you'll see his divergence from what you would think would be the natural translation as well. There is a great chumash called the Orech Yomim Chumash, which translates the Unkelus into Hebrew, which now sounds a little bit backwards, right? Because aren't I reading Hebrew in the first place? But the point is, no, you need to know the Hebrew or the Aramaic to understand what the Aramaic really is doing, right? And that's, so it is very helpful if you want to go in that route. Or you can just touch up on Aramaic, it's very helpful. When it comes to Targum Yonos and Nazil, Targum Yonos and Nazil, just two hallmarks. The Targum Yonos and Nazil, you don't really need to think about the methodology as much, because it's very clear he's diverging from the text, very, very much more so than the Targum Unkelus. But two points is, one is his relationship to Halacha, and the other one is his incorporation of Medrash. Those are the two things that the Targum Yonasan is going to be dealing with. So for instance, you'll see a number of times where the Targum Yonasan will acknowledge traditions found in the Targum in the Gemara, the Talmud Yerushalmi. So the Talmud Yerushalmi describes in Brachos in Source 29, V'ilein demetargumin ami b'nei Yisrael kamada ana rachman b'shamayim, Kad to heaven, Rachman in Ba'ara. They translate the Torah as that Hashem, you're merciful in heaven, be merciful upon the land. Torosa do Erechela Yosav Yosbara, Loi Tiskun Tero Tarveon be Yomachad, Loi Avdun Tavos, Shen Oisim Midos Shagosh Baruch Rachamim. When interpreting the mitzvah of Oisav Espinoi, which is not shechting a mother and a son on a mother animal and the child animal on the same day, and interpreting this as a expression of rachmim, the Gemara says loy avdin tavaus. This is in the Gemara in Brachos, which is describing that Mishnah where it says ad kan tzipor yagir rachamecha. There's certain things that you're not allowed to attribute to Hashem that you're limiting to rachmim. It seems in this case, if I'm understanding this correctly, in this case loy avdin tavaus. This is not a concern of making a Gosh Baruch Hu a Rachman, or limiting him to Rachmanus. And in fact, that is the Targum Yonasan, or the Targum Yerushalmi, on this Pasuk in Vayikra, where the Pasuk says, "Oshor Oseh Oisov Espinoi Lo Yisishchatu B'Yom Echad." You cannot shecht a Shor Oseh and its child on the same day. Look at the translation of the Targum Yerushalmi. Ami B'nei Yisrael Heichmo Da'avunun Rachman B'Shmaya Katevun Rachman in Ba'ara. Like Hashem is merciful in heaven, you, the children, should be merciful on earth. You can't therefore shecht an animal and its child on the same day. And so that seems to be directly pulled from the language of the Yerushalmi itself, which is fascinating, because then we're getting the tradition from the Yerushalmi tradition in understanding this pasuk, which is now imported into the actual pasuk itself. And the most famously, Targum Yonasan, the most famous, we'll call divergence or expansion that Targum Yonasan does, is to incorporate Medrash into the Pesukim. And he does this prolifically, and you can sort of read what seems to be a very simple Pesuk, and you'll have paragraphs, literally paragraphs, of the Targum Yonasan, and it's really, really fascinating to trace this. Two examples, very, very simple examples. It describes, Vayoel Moshe Losheves Esa Ish, Moshe Yoel is usually interpreted idea is that he makes an oath to stay with the person. That's where by Yoel and Moshe Rav, the Satmar Rebbe's Sefer comes from the name of this pasuk. He says Vayitain es Tzipora b'toy leMoshe, and he gives his daughter Tzipora to Moshe. So if you look at the Targum Onkelos, Targum Onkelos is very clear. But Tzavi, Moshe agrees. That you see that word appears in the Ksuba, right? But Tzavi da chasandana, but Tzvias moras. Right, so he agrees to stay. Moshe lemeisav im gavra, to stay with a person. Again, the word taf interchangeable with the word shin, the letter shin. Lemeitav is lemeishav im gavra, with that person. We have yos tzipora barte lemoshe, and he gave his daughter again. Barte is that's just an Aramaic word. Thank you. That's interchangeable. But there is to stay with him. So nothing new. Right, the Aramaic, the Onkelos is, I mean, he's interpreting Vayoel to be aggrieved at Savi. But listen to the Targum Yosef Mezil. Suddenly Targum Yosef Mezil goes off. Listen to this. The kad chachim Reuel de Orak Moshe min kodam para, when Reuel, that's Yisrael, realizes that Moshe Rabbeinu has run away from Yisrael, talak Yosef leguba, he throws him into a pit. The vahavos tzipora barte devrei mefaris sona Yosef besisra. So Tzipora would slip him bread, should secretly go and give him food. Bizman istere isarti shnin. It sounds like 10 or 11 years. Ulasoif isarti shnin. And after that amount of time, afkinin minuguva, he brought him out of this pit in his backyard in some sort of prison. Va'al Moshe begoi ginunisa de Ruel. He entered into the yard of Ruel. Va'av moidi umatzle kodam Hashem de abed ima nisin v'guvrin. And he thanked him for all the miracles. The istaka echias chutra the istabirias bebeine shimsha vechak yon umforish alosh shmor rabbi yakira debay osid lemeva yos timhaya b'mitzrayim. And he now came across the staff which was inscribed on the staff the names of our Kodesh Baruch Hu, which is going to do the miracles in Egypt. Ubei Ovid Lemizva Yos Yaman is going to split the sea with us. Disuf Ulan Pakas Moi min Kefa Vavadoyitz Bagoy Gininusa Umin Yad Oishit Yidei Venasbe Ho Bechain Tsovi Moshe Lemetov Im Gavra. So when Yisrael now accepts him, that's when he agrees to. So like there's like 10 years that has happened in this pasuk, right? Mm-hmm. And this is all a midrash which comes in the happens in this case the Yalkut Shimoni, which describes this, and there's more details there. Tarav Yonason is pulling that all the subtext to the story and putting it in. Mm-hmm. Another example over here, and we'll close with this, is later on, Vahiba Derep Amalon, Vayivkasheu Hashem, Vayivakasheu Lamisoi. Hashem wants to kill Moshe Rabbeinu on his way down to Egypt, right? He's going to Egypt at this point in time. Why is he going to be killed? So we know that he has a child who's not circumcised. So you say, which child is not circumcised? So you say ostensibly Eliezer, because Eliezer is the second son, and he probably, it sounds like, you know how it goes, moves and children getting born always happen the same time, right? Isn't that true? Think about how many times you've moved, and it's just about the time of a birth, right? Seems to just be the way it is. So you say, okay, so Eliezer was born, they're moving, he's in the hotel, he hasn't had a chance for a bris, they can't find a caterer, right? And so it comes along Tzipora and saves. That's not what happens. That's not what happens, says the Targum Yonasan, based on the Medrash Mechilt in this case. He says, Vahava Ba'ar, so look again, the Targum Onkelos is very simple. Vahava Ba'archa Ba'beis Mavsa, Va'ara Ba'i Malacha Da'ashem Ubal Mikhtala, this angel comes and wants to kill him. But says the Targum Yonasan, Vahava Ba'archa Ba'vei Miv Toysa, so they're at the inn, Va'ara Ba'i Malacha Da'ashem Ubal Mikhtala, and wanted to kill him. Why? Lemin biglal Gershom Berei, because of their first son Gershom, Deloy have a gazir who was not circumcised at that point. Al esak Yisroi Chomoy, because of the business with Yisroi, his father-in-law, Deloy shavke lemigzere Baram Eliezer have a gozer bitnoi da asniu traveon. But they actually made an agreement where Eliezer got the bris, but not Gershom. So you say, wow, what's going on over here? That means that Gershom wasn't circumcised at this point. And the answer is yes. If you go to the Midrash Michil, to the Midrash explains that when Yisroi and Moshe Rabbeinu made that agreement we just learned about a moment ago, Yisroi says, listen, I'll let you marry my daughter as long as the first child goes to Avodah Zarah. Moshe said, no problem, that's Vayol Moshe. Moshe agrees. That was the conditions of marriage. So you're like, that's Moshe Rabbeinu? Yeah. He allows his child not to be. So the answer is, as is understood by Rav Shimon Schwab and Mayan Bessa Shoeva in interpreting that medrash, is what happens is that Yisro says, it's not that he wants him to be Yitav Avodah Zarah. Yisro says, is that I discovered God through the process of discovery. Of I strapped my guitar on my back, I went to the Himalayas, I tried to find God wherever it was, and I found God. That's what it was. I tried out all these things. I became the Kamer Avodah Zarah. I was a priest in all these different shrines, and I found truth. I want my grandchildren to have the same opportunity of finding truth, not because they were insulated in a Hasidic cheder only speaking Yiddish. I want them to be able to go and discover the world and find the truth. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, you know, we'll do two educational tracks here. It'll be number one, will be the one who does it Yisro style, and the other one will be mine, which is why their names are different, right? Gerashon, Gera Yisro Eretz Nachriya, a sojourner in a foreign land. That's the Yisro child. And Eliezer, Elokei of Ibe Ezri, that's God, right? That's like Kodesh Baruch Hu's, right? Which is why Eliezer got the circumcision, and Gerashon didn't. Apparently now, as he returns to Israel, that's no longer all right. Right, so as he's on his way back, that's when the Malach comes and Sipporah needs to take action as well. But you would have never have interpreted, you never understood that if you didn't have the augmenting of the measures, the subtext of what's going on, all incorporated into the Targum Yonasan as well. So Targum Yonasan is not only doing what the Targum Unkelus is doing, what he's doing is he's incorporating into it the milieu of hundreds of Midrashim, which are now found and understood as the subtext of the story, which is really, really fascinating. Notice, by the way, at this point in time, we're not now encountering a Midrash, we're not interpreting an interpretation of the text al pi pshat, right? So the Midrash are not trying to say what was the intent over here, what do I think this means. This is simply what we'll call rendition of tradition as incorporated into it. When we want to get to the realm of pshat, we're going to now move hundreds of years forward, Bezra Hashem, and start moving into the early Rishonim, and that's going to be the next stage of our Intzigah. Really, really fascinating. Thank you for taking the time. I hope it's going to be a meaningful experience. Thank you. Oh, wow, I didn't realize it was so late.